I'm curious, do you have a really great BS detector? Maybe you're often skeptical of others. Are you really street smart? Would you say you're pretty self-assured? You often find yourself being the leader in the group. Maybe you even struggle to ask for help. Do you love a good challenge? Do you fight really hard for the causes you believe in? Do you have a great sense of humor? I bet you're a blast. You might have thought that these were all parts of your personality, but they might actually be coping mechanisms you've picked up over the course of your life, and they're having a huge impact on how you show up, especially on this motherhood journey. Are you curious to know more? You got to take my personality patterns quiz. Here's what's going on. When you were a child, whenever an experience overwhelmed your nervous system, you subconsciously built a defense against that overwhelm. Over time, those defenses became a habit, and then they became a pattern. And now as an adult, what we think of as our personality is often this defense pattern running the show. It's so interesting, right? There are 5 different personality patterns, and they're not personality types like the Enneagram or the Myers-Briggs, but rather they describe the safety strategies that we immediately go to when we start to feel overwhelmed. They don't describe who we are so much as what's blocking who we are. The good news is that once you take my quiz and learn about your pattern, you can learn skills to break out of that pattern, and then you can live and parent your kids as your true and authentic self. Click on the quiz link in the show notes or go to michellegrosser.com/quiz now to take my 2-minute personality pattern quiz. Welcome to the Calm Mom Podcast, the show for ambitious women ready to get off the hot mess express. I know you've got a lot going on. You work so hard. You're raising an incredible family. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. I'm your host, Michelle Grosser. I'm a certified master life coach, attorney, wife, and mom. And years ago, I was right where you are. I was running a busy law practice while raising a family, and I was on the fast track to burnout. I thought I just needed to be more organized or have better routines, but it was learning how to heal and regulate my nervous system that expanded my capacity to gracefully hold more of this big, beautiful life. You too are worthy of an extraordinary life in and beyond motherhood. Learning to be a calm, anchoring presence in your home and at work is going to be your superpower. If you're here to do the inner work that brings a sense of calm amidst the chaos, I'm here to join you on that journey. Each time you press play, your growth continues. So let's get at it. Hey, you guys, Michelle here. I'm so excited that you guys decided to listen to today's episode because on the show today, we have Busy Gold. Busy is one of the top personal development and wellness experts in the world. She is the founder of The Break Method, which is this logic-based, process-oriented approach to emotional rewiring. You guys know I'm always talking about alternatives to traditional talk therapy, and this is one of them. It's massive. She has over 15,000 clients in 23 countries, and it's a program that is just really disrupting how we talk about our mental health, how we think about our emotional patterning, right? How do we take a look at what happened in our childhood and how that's showing up in our adulthood? So many of the things we talk about on this show. So in today's episode, I think you guys are going to learn a lot. We talk a lot about parenting, specifically about what we often refer to as helicopter parenting, right? How are we actually holding our kids back by being over their shoulder in everything they do, right? How are we removing opportunities for their growth and their independence and really their development, because we take away a lot of these opportunities because they're uncomfortable for us. We want to make sure that they're safe or they're inconvenient for us or whatever it is. So I think this conversation is going to open your eyes in some ways, and I think that's going to be really awesome. So enjoy this conversation with Busy. I would love to hear what you guys think about it. Let me know. All right, Busy, welcome to the Calm Mom Podcast. So grateful to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome. So I'm really excited because just before we hit record, I was asking you what kind of things you're really passionate about these days and want to make sure that our audience hears about. So we're going to be talking a lot about things that we can do, especially in early parenthood to make sure that we help support our kids' mental health and things that are rooted, I'm sure, in the research and the science. So I can't wait. But before we jump into that, tell everyone a little bit about you, all the things that you're doing, all the spaces that you're filling. Let us know all about you.
I'm Busy Gold. I'm the founder of Break Method. Break Method is a data analytics approach to emotional rewiring, and we work with individuals, families, and couples. Break is a sustainable program that's built on a set structure. So one of the things that we've found that tends to hold clients back in the process of traditional talk therapy is that if their preference is able to guide the flow of their sessions, they won't ever heal. Our preference is a byproduct of our brain pattern, and the brain pattern ultimately doesn't want to get healed and rewired because it believes that the destiny it has planned for you is the best case scenario, right? It thinks it's keeping you safe. It's created rules during early childhood of known cause and effect. So it causes you subconsciously to repeat the same things over and over again to feel safe. But ultimately, we know that those things are tied to our biggest heartbreaks, our self-sabotage, our chaotic communication cycles. So typically what the client believes they want for themselves and the way their brain pattern are currently interacting, it's going to make it feel like they're constantly stuck, repeating things, never able to get where they want to go. And if that client goes to a traditional talk therapy container and they're asked narrative-based questions about how their day was or how did you feel about that, you're communicating from that narrative place that's completely infused with all those subconscious patterns, and you can't see your way out of it. So in this way, what we've found is most clients are operating in such deep self-deception that they can't effectively answer a question in a way that actually could help them heal. So what we've found is that when a client is faced with that set structure where their preference can't dictate what they work on that day or are able to answer that question with their narrative, they end up having to face the conflict. They have to face the error in their thinking.
Yep.
And they can see very clearly in a linear format that the way they're perceiving reality as matched with the goals that they most want to achieve in their lives have an illogical connection. Mm-hmm. There's no possible way, if we just look at the data on the page, there's no way to achieve the thing you want to achieve with the thing that you're thinking. So then the client has to go through a process by which they're unwinding the systems of language that brain pattern generated in early childhood. And that's really, I think, the place that we land in this conversation, which is, I think the average person does not understand that their biggest issue in life, be it with communication, with career, with self-sabotage, with parenting, happened between ages 2 and 4.
Yeah.
And I think it's a hard concept for people to understand because many of us are socially programmed to believe that kids have the memory of a dog. Oh, they're going to get over that. They're not going to remember that. You are going to remember that. And even if you consciously don't remember it, your body and your brain do and are patterned that way, whether you like it or not.
That's right. And I think, so I'm hearing a couple things in that, and then I want to get into the parenting thing. Mm-hmm. One, and I try to reiterate this as much as I can when we have an opportunity, because so much of the growth that we're seeking requires an immense level of leaning into discomfort. And I'm hearing that in the Break Method. And then I'm also hearing that we're completely blind to the depth of our blind spots, frankly.
Yes.
Right? So talk to me a little bit about that interplay, because it's quite an act of humility, I would assume, to enter something like Break Method and allow yourself to face how much you're actually missing that's required for you to get to where you want to be.
So there's a very specific moment that all of our clients find that we've aptly titled reality vertigo. There's a certain moment where you get through the work, and part of the way Break works is that the client can't understand what's being asked or why we're asking a certain question, because then your brain can mask, it can cover, it can distort if it knows what we're trying to use it for. So the client is effectively kept in the dark about most of why we're bobbing and weaving through information the way that we are. Mm-hmm. And then every about second or third video, they then learn how to go back and reflect on the data that we just extracted, right? So when we're looking at it this way, that self-deception becomes uncovered because you don't understand why you're being asked about certain things. So you basically can't lie and cover. But then when you're of sound mind, you go back and we say, okay, grab all these pieces. Now I want you to look at these pieces this way. And in doing so, you effectively do get slapped with this moment where you realize, oh my God, these things felt so rational in the moment, but I can see their completely illogical nature. And that is when that reality vertigo moment kicks in. Wow. Where you, once you have to face it and there's no running from it because it was nobody but you, right? It's just you and you, you have to face it. Then it means that you have to be willing to retroactively look back at years, possibly, right? We have clients that are in their 60s and 70s, 70 yeah. years of self-deception, yeah. where you now maybe have that one spark where you realize, oh my God, those three partners that I had in my 20s, they weren't lying. There is some truth to that. I can do X, Y, Z without being aware that I'm doing it. So yeah. that's when the reality vertigo kicks in, where all of a sudden one piece of information, think of it like a puzzle piece, gets mm-hmm. popped into that puzzle. And all of a sudden, for the first time, you're having to actually face reality and yeah. the gravity of having to fit that puzzle piece in. It's intense and it can make you feel like you're losing your mind for a moment.
Yes.
Thankfully, yeah. with Break Method, we're able to support the client and we know exactly when that moment's going to happen so that we can step in, triage, nurture, cheerlead if we have to get them through that moment, because that moment has to happen for each one of us. That moment of reality vertigo is where the healing actually begins, because we can't heal from something we're unwilling to acknowledge exists.
That's right.
Just like we can't rewire a trigger that we refuse to expose ourselves to. Yeah. And both of those operate in tandem. Our brain tries to get us to feel very logical, avoiding the very things that hold the keys to our healing.
Yes, yes. My listeners always hear me say that, you know, awareness always precedes choice, and we can't intervene in a world we can't see. And that's yes. what I hear you saying. We have a group program called Restore, and the week that we just did this week is all about like the people look at their coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so many of the things that I help work them through that are coping strategies are things that we just think are a personality, right? And yes. I'm sure most of them are formed in really early childhood.
Between two right and five. Now. We can prove it with data. Between yeah. two and five, so part of what Break Method does is, and we can get into this a little bit later, but I'll give kind of a 2-second snapshot because I think that it's helpful.
Yeah.
Break Method, instead of a traditional client container where you're being asked again questions like, well, what happened then? How did you feel about that? We actually, in the very first appointment, we track actual hard raw data. So examples would be, were your parents married? If they were married, for how long were they married? Did you have siblings? And then understanding more about the interplay between academic support, academic achievement goals. Yeah. When people look back at their childhood, I think when we think of therapy, people are thinking about feelings and emotions, but it's really the setup of the environment and the structures and the repetition mm-hmm. or lack of repetition of those structures that formulate your brain pattern. So when we look through some of those early childhood data inputs, that's what we're looking for. It's like, were the parents using drugs or alcohol? Was there any sort of religious foundation? Was that religious foundation also given conflicting messages with behavior? Things like that, where it's not about how you felt about it. It's like, what was the actual repetitive setup? Yeah. And that's essentially where you're coming in from. Because that is what creates your coping mechanisms. It's not yeah. how you feel about something.
That's
it's
right.
It's the actual structure of your environment.
Right. And then it's a cycle, right? Because then it's reinforced. Mm-hmm. And then our nervous system is like, that was effective for dealing with whatever stressor this was. And we just keep perpetuating it.
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. So I want to kind of get into how we can set up our kids best for success in those early years. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, can we just do like some sort of disclaimer, because I don't want this conversation to make listeners like have this take on this sense of guilt if they have kids that are older or in yeah. it. So I would love for you to just speak on that for a second, and then let's kind of go through what you want to teach today.
Absolutely. So, you know, most of the clients that I work with have kids that are fully grown. And thankfully, I get to, in my job, I often get to work with multiple generations. So I've had like the grandma and the daughter and the daughter's kids. So I'll have like simultaneously a 65-year-old, a 41-year-old, and their 8 and 12-year-old daughter. So I get to, that's how my job is daily. So I come face to face with this all the time, that moment of regret where when you see the inputs that create the output and you have that moment of awareness and then you realize, oh my God, I did this to my kids.
Yeah.
Let it be known. I did it to my kids. You did it to your, like, we're all going to do things to our kids that in hindsight, being 2020, we're going to wish we did differently.
Yes.
I personally think that guilt is a very useless emotion. It's important for us. And I don't know the spiritual belief systems of the people listening, but I know for me, I am a Christian. And for me, the act of having to face the reality of what you've done and choose differently means that you can't be in guilt. Guilt and shame drive you into the spiral where you're not able to truly face it and change it. Mm-hmm. You're just more living in regret and remorse and replaying the past.
Yes.
I think true repentance pushes you into forward momentum, yes. Right? I see the error and I'm going to change my thinking on that. And I'm going to do it differently.
Yep.
So to level the playing field with many of my clients who are working on parenting strategy, I remind them that while I'm teaching these things and I'm an effective teacher, that doesn't mean that I've done everything 100% correctly, right? None of us have.
Yeah.
And what I've found is that even for my clients that have grown children who are 40s, 50s, or maybe you have a teenage daughter or son, it's never too late to learn the skills that we teach in Break Method, because sometimes a very elegant, simple form of communication, knowing what you parented with an input that did harm, you can unwind that whole thing with one phrase. And wow. I've seen it happen time and time again, because there's a disconnect in the child's brain, because often our parenting strategy, if you will, is maybe they didn't see that the way I did. I'll just move on and pretend it didn't happen. Or This is one of my jokes, but sometimes parents will kind of do this wave your hands, like, you're going to remember the story the way I tell you to remember it, right? And then we just kind of hope maybe they'll just label it the way that I tried to convince them it happened, even though deep down in my heart, I know it didn't happen that way. Both of those parenting strategies, they do harm. And we can unwind that harm by going up to our child once we've learned all the things that we've done or inputted incorrectly in Break. We can go to them and be like, hey, I know this sounds silly, but remember when you were 6 and XYZ was happening and you came to me and said XYZ and I tried to make you feel like you're crazy? You know, that really did happen. And I just couldn't admit it to myself at that time.
Yeah.
You would be, I mean, that sort
validating.
Of validating, but also helping the child consider both parties' perspectives. Like, hey, this is what was going on in my mind at the time. And I really felt in hindsight, like I was making the right choice, but now I see the error in that. That can heal generations.
Yes.
But keeping things swept under the rug and just pretending like they never happened, or trying to convince the other party that they saw it in a way that wasn't really accurate, and then just trying to move forward and keep your head buried in the sand, that's not an effective parenting strategy. So We've all done harm. Mm-hmm. Some of us completely by accident and unknowingly, mm-hmm. and some of us have done harm and we've known in the moment that we're doing harm.
That's right.
Either way, I think it's important when you're approaching work like this, you have to start with the clean slate and say, okay, I'm forgiving myself for every mistake that I've made up to this point, because for me to actually take the information that people like you and I are trying to share, you have to be willing to literally start fresh and tell myself, I didn't know better, therefore I wasn't doing better. But now, and this is the key, now that we are sharing this information with you, now the responsibility is on your shoulders.
Yes.
Because now you do know better, and it's up to you to take this moment to change the rest of your life and stop repeating the mistakes of the past.
Yeah.
So I think that's what happens, is people can get stuck in guilt and shame. And then because of that, they don't truly see the error of their thinking. And then they do just keep repeating the same thing. So I think this is the gift of the moment we all find ourselves in right now, is that like a confessional, you can like absolve yourself right now and move forward. But if you're going to keep listening from this point forward, now you do have the responsibility to do things differently.
Yeah. Time to take some action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love it. Okay. All right. So let's jump in. So start wherever you see fit, but I kind of want to talk through some things that we can do in those really critical years to ensure that our kids are developing in the way that is best for them long term. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So the number one correlation that we've found with positive outcomes has everything to do with self-efficacy. When you provide the environment that allows a child to build self-efficacy in those early years, 2, 3, 4, you have a completely different outcome in a child. What I've found in the last, let's say 4 or 5 years, but I've seen the trend happening long before that. There's a trend toward more this attachment style parenting, where you're overly coddling, you're meeting your child's every need, and you're not creating much separation. Your child's not able to really establish autonomy and independence, because you're programmed to believe that anytime your child makes any noise or needs anything, it's your duty to be there immediately.
Right.
Let me tell you, this is a recipe for absolute disaster. And I always go back to the data. We've worked with a data analytics firm to pull back through every single one of our client records. And I can show you where this client outcome is directly tied to this childhood input. When the parent does not help the child, number one, establish self-efficacy, but number two, provide intentional opportunities for delayed gratification, you're also setting your child up for failure. Yeah. An example that is very relevant to the toddler phase is every toddler goes through the uppies phase. Uppies, I want uppies, 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 uppies. It's like, well, I'm cooking with hot oil right now. This is not a good opportunity for uppies, you know? So this is just a simplified example, but especially for first-time parents, and I have four kids, just for context, I know with first kid, you know, there's that part of you that if they need anything, you just immediately, they cry and you want to jump. Then with kid two, you've toughened yourself up a little bit and you're like, no, it's good for you. You can take a moment. Right now I'm on kid four. So I really get it at a different level than I did almost now 14 years ago with my first child. When your kid really wants uppies, I'll use my son River as an example. He's two and he's definitely going through the uppies phase right now. It's not about shaming your kid for wanting uppies and being like, no, I'm not giving, right? It's not about giving them attitude,
right?
But your child is feeling something that they want to soothe you to help them soothe, right? They're trying to co-regulate. And I think there's this idea that all co-regulation is automatically beneficial. And that's absolutely unequivocally false. When you allow your child to co-regulate all the time, they don't learn how to self-regulate. You can't by nature learn how to self-regulate if you're always co-regulating. They are antagonistic to each other. So in this scenario, I've got a couple of goals. Number one, I want my child to learn how to self-soothe. Number two, I want my child to learn that they can be in close proximity to me and be around me and engage with me without me always having to physically pick them up.
Yeah.
So if I look at it this way, and my son is saying uppies, 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 I'll look at my son and say, honey, I love you so much. Mommy's cooking with hot oil right now. I need to help them try to understand what I'm doing. Because that's one step that I think some parents miss, is that they don't understand that their child's language capacity doesn't match their intellect, and that their intellect actually can't understand what you're saying, even if they can't responsively verbalize that to you, right? So I talk to all of my kids with the information that I would give someone like you or like my husband.
Right.
And because of that, I mean, by the way, their language skills bud and all these other things improve. But
yeah.
I explain what I'm doing so that he understands the context of the situation that we find ourselves in.
Yes.
He keeps saying uppies, and I give him a choice, which is, mommy can't pick you up right now, but if you want to be close to me, you can hold on to my leg from back here, but I need you not to be near the stove. Right, he can still say uppies, and again, I can reinforce what I'm doing. And at that point, then I'm going to stay focused on my cooking. And as long as he's away from the hot oil, at that point, I've given him every stimulus he needs to learn how to regulate. And at that point, I'm not going to engage with it anymore. I'm not going to kick him off my leg. He can stay touching my leg. But he needs to learn that he can be close to me without getting exactly what he wants when he wants it.
Yes,
because I'm showing him you can be close to me. I love you. I'm not going anywhere. But also, this scenario is not right for you to be in my arms. It's not safe for you, and it's not right. You need to learn how to be okay and establish that self-regulation with autonomy. So, simple example, but think about how many parents wouldn't do that. They'd try to find a way to grab the child with the splashing, right? And then they're all stressed out and they start yelling at everybody else. Because with parenting, it's always a snowball effect.
Yes.
So another example of learning an opportunity to help your child build self-efficacy. So my daughter Harley climbed up. We have like a big play kitchen. So Harley is three. She climbed up on this play kitchen and I'm doing other things. There's lots going on. And I'm watching and observing as she's doing it. And I'm realizing pretty quickly, the way she did this, she's going to have a hard time getting back down.
Yeah. Right?
That's going to happen.
Yeah.
And how many parents, if you're listening, would watch that and all of a sudden be like, oh my God, my baby, they're going to have, right? You want to go into that panic mode.
Yeah.
And what about when your child starts panicking, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of you would then match that panic with panic.
That's right.
What should happen is this. You look at them, you say, wow, Harley, I mean, that was pretty brave that you went up there. How are you going to get back down? Have you looked down and thought about your strategy to get down? Instead of, oh my God, or you go and you rescue them, help them, use your voice to guide them into the right questions to help them put the logical pieces together. Where am I going to put my foot?
Mm-hmm.
Was this a good decision? Instead of just immediately removing them from it.
Yes.
Harley ended up getting herself down because I guided her through the process and I let her know, you're okay, you're safe. Even if you fell, that's not that high. I think you'd be okay. Do you think you'd be okay? Maybe I'd be okay. So she slowly, methodically gets herself down. And guess what? The next time she does that again, she's not going to panic because she's going to know how to get herself down. Mm-hmm. But we often miss these little opportunities to help a child learn how to think yep. in a moment of stress and navigate themselves out of it because we just rescue them all the time.
Yes. Okay. I could not like put my seal of approval or my stamp of approval on all of this more. I'm really passionate about this stuff too. And I always tell my kids, I'm like, my number one job is to keep you safe. And then after that, my number two job is to make sure that you can like go out and operate in this world without me, right? Like mm-hmm. I don't want to.
Amen.
That's what it is. And I'm hearing so much in this that I want to break down. And I guess kind of where I want to start is about our children's ability to learn how to self-regulate, right? Mm-hmm. Like we know that we share nervous system with them, right, through a lot of those early years. And I was actually talking about this in a one-on-one coaching call last week. And I want to talk about it with you because I think so often when we rush to rescue our kids, especially from some of their emotions that we are uncomfortable with, one, we're robbing their opportunity to learn how to sit with that. And then second, I think we are often very blind to how quick we are to offer distraction or to bring forth what are actually going to become suppression tactics for them overall, right? Like we want it like, here's your stuffy or here's a snack and get them to stop crying and get them, keep them happy. So, and
I mean, because I was going to say it's the budding of coping mechanisms.
It
Whatever
is.
It is that you use to distract them and soothe them will become part of their coping
mechanism. And we're also sending the message that this is bad. Let's just stop this as quickly as we can, right? Mm-hmm. Which is also a message that we don't want to be sending about any kinds of emotions, right? Doesn't mean they can do whatever they want when they're upset. But we're not sending a message that like, we must stop crying now. This is really, really bad. I wonder if you could speak in to that a little bit about the distraction and like how we, it's really about us and our own discomfort in letting
Absolutely. And there are certain, so we've found that all of humanity distills down to 5 brain pattern types. And within okay. each of those brain pattern clusters, I can predict all of your future behavior to a point that usually freaks people out a little
this
bit.
Is like fascinating.
How from this one appointment could you know more about me than 10 years of therapy? Well, it has everything to do with your brain pattern type. So there are certain brain pattern types that are resistant to allowing any escalation because any escalation feels like it will potentially put everyone's safety at risk. So even if a child's crying for a minute, they would rather borrow from the future or borrow from that child's future adulthood to just soothe them in that moment to keep the peace. And therefore, everything is about keeping the peace in the present moment rather than doing what's best for that child long term.
Yes.
So that brain pattern type is about 25% of the population. Then there's another brain pattern type that will want to do that same thing, but for very different reasons, right? Brain pattern type one, they want to keep the peace.
Okay.
So they're willing to give you that snack or do whatever just to get you to stop crying because they just want things calm.
Yep.
The other type is going to want things to stop because it means that they're a bad parent or they're doing something wrong. So they want it to stop because of some perceived reflection on them as a parent.
Yeah.
Then there are subsets of each of those two. Okay. Then there's the parent that won't care and will completely ignore the child and won't care that they're crying and won't offer any sort of engagement and just be like, oh, they'll just cry it out, right? That has its own, I think no one here is recommending that. There's a certain way to engage with your child to let them know that you're present to what's going on, you're engaging with them, but also you're not coddling and you're not stepping in and
enabling.
Saving them all the time. Exactly, enabling. But you also don't just want to do nothing, right?
That's,
where that's a very specific pattern type as well, where they're just kind of like, oh, whatever, they'll figure it out. It'll make them tougher, but you just completely ignore.
Right.
For what it's worth, that will typically create major attachment issues if you just do that, right? Because then anytime they do have that connection, it will be much more the anxious attachment style presentation.
Right.
Then you have the parents that want to step in and engage, but at the same time are very black and white in their thinking. And they tend to be the parents that can be more condemning, punishing, and end up making the child essentially turn on themselves for their whatever their perceived need was then becomes a problem and they start to feel like a burden.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the parent steps in to help essentially turns the kid internally into I'm doing something wrong instead of understanding where they have the opportunity to self-regulate, they just come down on themselves and essentially instead of building self-efficacy or getting their need met, they just have to turn on themselves internally. They usually have a major identity crisis. They lose self-trust. right? Because one of the outcomes of self-efficacy is high level of self-trust.
Yes.
Right. When we, yes. That's one of the things we want our children to build. But when you have that parenting style that we were just talking about, the kid has to be self-trust negative because the parent always wants to be right. The parent's never willing to concede. The parent's never willing to give the child a chance to express their opinion. Everything's just shut down. So you're creating a self-trust negative child by way of being that condemning, really supporting conformity. Conformity is another thing where, I mean, we could do this as a 10-hour podcast, but conformity, as much as many of our previous generations thought that that was the way to set a child up for success, right? Like, kids are better seen and not heard. Do it this way. Our religion wants you to be this. Mm-hmm. That also doesn't help support self-efficacy because every child is not the same. So if you just tell a kid, everyone squeeze into this box, by nature, they'll have to turn on some aspect of themselves to fit themselves into the box, therefore becoming, again, self-trust negative.
Right. Not to mention then in 15 years, we're going to tell them now to do the opposite and not do what everyone is doing and go against peer pressure and everything. And that just becomes confusing, I'm sure. And man, this is fascinating. Okay. So for people who are listening back to your kind of your Uppies example or any of these, I'm sure that there are some women listening that are like, yeah, that sounds great. I would love to be able to respond to my kids like that and not, you know, give in to everything that they're wanting or demanding. But then it ends up where my kid's just like throwing a fit. And like, what do I do at that point? Like, what's the step? So you set your boundary,
I'll give you guys a few steps. And this is what, so within Break Method, there's something specific we do called the Parenting Club, which is all behavior strategies specific to things like this. So we often work with kids that have oppositional defiant disorder, but a whole host of issues that are taking place in the home from either the parents not knowing how to enforce consequences or not having systems set up in their household. Those are all the things that we build in the Parenting Club. So I will say, general disclaimer is when we understand everyone's brain pattern type, what we do is very specific to not just that child, but that parent and that child. So I'll give general recommendations, but just a disclaimer that part of the reason Break Method is so effective is that it is specific to that parent and that child, and that general things generally don't work. So when we think of this situation, we'll use, which one do you want to use? Do you want to use Uppies or the getting on top of the kitchen and not being able to get back down? Which one do you want to use for this one?
I feel like they're different, right? Because I feel like the second one is such more like a different, it's what I love
the
about
the second one's second danger one. Or safety based. And then the first one is a little bit more,
it's not fear based, which I love. Because I think a lot of parenting is fear based, right? It's like all the loop that's going.
A parent hypothetically, many parents would be in fear in that situation, right? Yeah, where their kid is dangling off the edge of something that could tip over, they could hurt the right.
Yeah.
Not every parent is gonna see that as something scary, but I think the majority of moms will.
I think so too. Talk about
dads, maybe not so much. Oh, they'll be fine. Like, no, I don't know. My husband and I were just talking about this morning or yesterday. My husband's always in a shop with lots of power tools and wrenches and all these things. And my son River loves to be like daddy. Everything he does is trying to make a power tool sound. And I see him walking around holding wrenches and screwdrivers. And in my head, I'm like, okay, please God, protect my kid. Don't let him try to fit it in the light socket. Like, please. But I'm working on myself and not trying to tell my husband what to do with his own child, you know? Mm-hmm. So we all have those thresholds. And for me, it's my kid walking around with a wrench or a screwdriver at age two and being like, this is going to be fine. And it's usually fine. Yep. So why don't we'll do this. I'll give a quick example for both. We'll start with the stove and then we'll move to the kids' playhouse. So a couple things could be happening in the stove scenario. Some of us, maybe cooking's our only peaceful time, right? You might be the kind of person where you're enjoying peace. Cause I think for the parent, the state of mind that you are in when this scenario is happening is very important, right? Yes. It's not just the scenario. We can't separate your experience and perception of reality from the scenario itself.
Yes.
So let's say, and this would certainly be the case for me, I love cooking. So if I'm cooking, I'm enjoying myself. Maybe, you know, my husband's in the playroom playing with the kids and River kind of wanders into the kitchen while I'm enjoying my cooking. So a couple things are happening. Maybe number one, it's disrupting your personal peace or a moment you thought you were having to yourself. Or maybe to contrast, you don't have any help and you don't like cooking and you're already really stressed out and you're trying to get food on the table while there's a million other things happening. So let's set the stage there. So keep in mind, number one, your personal state matters to how you're going to take that next step. One of the things that is very important is we often are reactive in what we say and do. And I think one of the things we have to get better at as parents is remembering that every single thing that we say, every eyebrow raise, every shoulder shimmy, all of it has deeper meaning to our kids. Yeah. And it's better to ignore your child for a solid minute while internally you're taking a breath and running yourself through your personal list of questions before you respond than it is to quickly and snappily respond to your kid. So number one is, no matter what state of mind you're in, take a beat. You don't have to answer your kid immediately at the first uppies and run yourself through, what is my long-term goal here? Yeah. And when we figure out what our goal is, we can then also get clear on what's motivating us in this moment. We have to understand our motivation to figure out how we're going to take that next step. So let's say in this situation, my goal is, even though I'm super annoyed right now stirring my food, my goal is that I want my child to learn that I'm there for them and that I'm a person that they can depend on, but that I'm not their slave and I'm not their butler. And they're going to have to, and they're going to have to learn to self-regulate in a situation where I can't physically be there for them.
That's right.
So if I run through that in my head, then I understand what I can and can't say, right? I'm not going to say something that shames them or yells at them or belittles them or like pushes them, flicks them off my leg with my foot, right? None of those are things that I can do to match the goal that I just set for myself. Although, let's be honest, for some of you in your mind, you might be that annoyed that your body's instinct is to literally flick them off your leg like a dog is grabbing your leg. And there's nothing, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's not about shame. That's one of these things that we have to remember, that these brain patterns are affecting you at a subconscious level even more than they're affecting your conscious awareness. Yeah. Therefore, they're affecting your soma and your physical body. So even if you mentally are like, I love my child, your leg might be like, I want to kick my child off my leg like a dog. Yeah. That doesn't make you an evil human being. It just means that there's a conflict right now between your subconscious and your conscious, right? So once we acknowledge, what is the goal? Well, my goal is I want my kid to do X, like we just talked about. How am I physically feeling right now? And how am I going to have to talk myself off this ledge before I say anything, right? Because I don't, these are the things that I don't want to do that I'm not deeming acceptable for myself right now. Can I take a deep breath and execute one simple thing, right? So it's usually that formula. What's actually going on for me? What is my goal? What's my motivation here? Can I take a deep breath and oppose the pattern, which is, if my body is telling me I want to flick them off my leg, how can I take a breath, look down and look, match their eye level and say, I know it might be so frustrating right now. Mommy's cooking. So number one, you bring them into your perspective because they can't, they're all the way down there. They can't see what you're doing. They don't understand what cooking with hot oil is. But, and sometimes in this scenario, I'll even pick River up and be like, see what mommy's doing. And then I'll put him back down.
Yeah.
Right. You have to actually help them see it from your perspective. We can't just assume that they will. So that's usually step two, is give them a chance to actually see your perspective, because maybe they'll change their mind just based on that. Mm-hmm. If they don't and they still want uppies, then your job is to remind them that you love them and that they're safe and secure despite not following through on their request.
Yeah. I love that.
And sometimes your kid is going to, as we talked about, continue to escalate, and it's your job to not break at that point. It doesn't matter how much your kid escalates. Once you've run yourself through that process and you've set the boundary, you cannot back down. That's the key. You can't back down. I don't care if internally you've got to sit there and like pray to God the entire time. Please don't let me back down. Please don't let me back down. I can do this. That's fine, but don't break. That is the number one issue that I see, is that parents that go through this work, their tolerance needs to increase. They need to learn, my kid's not going to die if they have to cry for 5 minutes, and neither am I. I can get through this. I can do hard things.
That's
because in many cases, the emotional resilience of the parent is also lacking. So this is the key, is we all get to rewire these things together if we choose to step into the work, right? Mm-hmm. I get to build my emotional resilience because I clearly didn't have that done for me when I was a child. And in doing so, I build up my child's emotional resilience so they never turn out like me.
Right.
Win-win.
It's beautiful. And it's big work.
It's a big deal. It's generational, life-changing.
Changing generations. Big, big work.
I'm curious, do you have a really great BS detector?
Maybe you're often skeptical of others. Are you really street smart? Would you say you're pretty self-assured? You often find yourself being the leader in the group. Maybe you even struggle to ask for help. Do you love a good challenge? Do you fight really hard for the causes you believe in? Do you have a great sense of humor? I bet you're a blast. You might have thought that these were all parts of your personality, but they might actually be coping mechanisms you've picked up over the course of your life, and they're having a huge impact on how you show up, especially on this motherhood journey. Are you curious to know more? You got to take my personality patterns quiz. Here's what's going on. When you were a child, whenever an experience overwhelmed your nervous system, you subconsciously built a defense against that overwhelm. Over time, those defenses became a habit, and then they became a pattern. And now as an adult, what we think of as our personality is often this defense pattern running the show. It's so interesting, right? There are 5 different personality patterns, and they're not personality types like the Enneagram or the Myers-Briggs, but rather they describe the safety strategies that we immediately go to when we start to feel overwhelmed. They don't describe who we are so much as what's blocking who we are. The good news is that once you take my quiz and learn about your pattern, you can learn skills to break out of that pattern, and then you can live and parent your kids as your true and authentic self. Click on the quiz link in the show notes or go to michellegrosser.com/quiz now to take my 2-minute personality pattern quiz. Okay, and then talk to me, I guess, a little bit about the climbing on the kitchen.
Climbing on the house thing. So realistically, that one's more likely to affect people in more of that like safety, someone's physical safety is at risk, right? So it's going to feel more like overt danger, more overt fear rather than possible annoyance and burden, like someone pulling on you. So in this situation, what's interesting, and this is one of the concepts that we talk about in Break Method, we call it ELI, which is a process of rewiring our emotional responses with logic. What's interesting about this situation is if you were to go through logically, is the child in a safe situation? Technically, no, but it also really depends on how you're defining safety. Right. So this is where in Break Method, we would layer in more of this ELI questioning, because safety for each person, their definition of it is going to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. But in this specific scenario, the first step kind of, it would be at the same line of like, what is your goal and motivation? This is like, how am I actually defining safety? What really could happen here? If I let my kid take a little bit of risk, what are we looking at? Like possibly a bruise, possibly some tears, maybe a scrape. Am I willing to deal with that mm-hmm. in an effort to help my child become a fundamentally better human, right? That's like weighing the risk versus reward. Yep. Where it's like, if your kid is standing up on top of something really high where a fall could crack their skull and they're dangling near a like boiling bowl of pot or a pasta pot. Okay, different scenario. We've got to be able to take some measured risk here. Yes. So in this situation, if I run through like, what am I looking at here if they do fall? And is that something that I could be okay with in the pursuit of helping my child build self-efficacy? Cool. Mm-hmm. Then I know what my goal is. By going through that process, I now know, yes, even though this is going to be uncomfortable and my child might fall and I might have to live with, I was part of that choice. Mm-hmm. Can I live with that? So that's step one. Step two then is, you've got to ask yourself some questions about your emotional state, because let's say that you're in a very heightened emotional state. Do you think you're going to be a very good coach and ask the right questions to get your kids safely off the structure? No. Probably not. You're going to be like, oh my God, honey, but look at your foot. Oh my God, right? So you've got to remember that in this situation, if I let myself be reactive in how I'm speaking to my child, they're going to match my energy, and then they're going to be even more fearful about the next step that they take or where they're placing their hand. Yeah. So this is another one where it's like, once I've run through that risk versus reward, I've got to take a deep breath while also telling my kid, it's okay, honey. Mommy's gonna talk you through this. Let's ask ourselves some questions. Did you take a deep breath? Like if I just had to take a deep breath, maybe my child needs to take a deep breath. Do you need to take a deep breath?
Love it.
Okay. And then in a situation like this, if you were to think about, let's say I was in this situation, what would be the first thing I'd need to do? Well, I need to figure out where my physical body is in space, mm-hmm. right? So you kind of have to almost think about how it would be for you to guide your child off of a structure like this. Mm-hmm. And a child's body awareness, especially in those toddler years, it's not great, right? Hopefully, but, you know, sorry about the train, but My daughter at 3 obviously knows all of her body parts, but let's say they're even younger and they don't necessarily know all their body parts. You're going to have to get clever with how you're positioning the language. But for somebody like my daughter, if I were to then cue into the fact that I'm going to have to help her understand where her body is in space and get her to think about where she's going to have to move a hand or a foot to get mm-hmm. safely down, then I've kind of got my steps in mind. So yeah. Then I look at her body and I say, okay, Harley, let's take a look at where your feet are. Are you going to have to move your foot somewhere different to step down? Where's your hand? Can you find a place to put your other hand? Then we're just, instead of panicking, we're almost imagining ourselves like our voice has the ability to remote control our child's yes. body as long yeah. as we're effectively communicating. Mm-hmm. And if I'm emotionally activated, I'm not going to be an effective communicator. So the number one thing there is calm yourself, take some deep breaths. Anything that you tell yourself to do, let's also go ahead and tell our kid to do. Love and it. Then be aware of how you need their body to move through space and remember to ask it in question format.
Okay.
You don't want to be barking orders at them yeah. because then they're going to get in their head and they're going to feel potentially self-conscious. But if you ask the right questions, you're then starting that spark for them to learn how to ask themselves the right questions, which mm-hmm. that is self-efficacy.
Yeah.
Self-efficacy is getting them to the place where they can do all of the steps in sequence on their own without you having to remind them. So maybe in this situation, we start the first time by asking the right questions to help them be like, oh yeah, this is where my hand is. This is where my foot is. What do you think? Do you think you can jump down from there? Yeah, I think that you can do it, right? They jump down. They're like, oh my God, I did it. You're like, good job. The next time, let's say maybe it happens again. They're going to look at you and you could then simply just be like, remember how we did it the last time? Yeah, I think you got it. Mm-hmm. Just let me know if you need a little bit of help, but I think you got this. Then they're just going to go do it. And then maybe the third time they won't even look at you because they're like, I got this. Right. Yes. That's building self-efficacy.
Right.
But if you don't establish what's happening in your own body first and how that is going to come out infused through your words or your directives, we're setting our kids up for failure.
Yes. Yes. So much of it just starts with us. And like you talk about what you need to do during these moments to keep yourself in a place where you can parent at your best. And sometimes I'll just say over and over and over to myself in those moments where I'm getting to the place where I can then show up and parent how I want to, is I'm just like, peace begins with me. Peace begins with me. Cause I know that whatever tone I set is going to be a huge indicator of how this turns out. Yeah. Part of what I'm hearing too, as you're even giving this example about the climbing, is like, as parents, I want to be able to set, you know, the boundaries or like the guardrails without taking over and driving the car, right? It's like, mm-hmm. yes, you're safe and you need to have space to learn how to do this on your own. And I wonder if you could speak.
And we can't keep things too safe. Kids really, yes. kids need to be exposed to risk. And I think often in our society today, we don't expose our kids to enough risk.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about that, because I would love if you could give one, some practical ways that are good starting points for parents to start to let their kids play around with things that feel a little risky. And mm-hmm. then if, I don't know if it exactly ties into this, but I want you to talk to a little bit about how, I would assume we severely underestimate, just as parents today as a whole, what our kids are actually capable of, especially our really young.
I'm so glad you asked that. Yes. Okay. So maybe, are you cool with me reversing those questions?
Yes.
And I'm a firm believer that especially at those two, three, four ages, kids are far more capable than most people would ever give them credit for. Agreed. And here's a perfect example. So again, my son River, 2, most mornings he actually makes my coffee. Legitimately, he makes my coffee. We have a routine. I sit him up on the counter. He likes to fumble through the Keurig pods. He finds the Keurig pod. He takes out the old one. He knows how to open up the machine. Yeah. He takes it out, sets it down. Then he puts the new Keurig pod in. He closes it. Mm-hmm. And he also walks over the coffee cup. So that's step one, is he comes over to the cabinet with me. I let him hold the coffee mug, right? Could it break? It totally could, but that's his thing. He yep. knows he's got to be careful. And I stand behind him and he moves it over. And then I lift him up on the counter. We do those steps I just described. He knows how to push it down, how to hit the buttons. And then he, as soon as it starts dripping out, he pulls back because I taught him how to do this and he goes, hot. And I'm like, yeah, hot. And then we sit there and we watch it like drip, drip, drip. And he goes, ready. And I grab my coffee and he goes, Milkies? Yeah, I put a little bit of Milkies in it. And he goes, mmm. I'm like, yeah, mmm, so good. So a lot of parents, there's so many steps of that they would be like, A, he just turned 2. Yeah, right. Or B, you're really going to let your kid hold a breakable mug all the way across the kitchen, or you're going to let him hit all these buttons or be around
boiling
hot water.
Right?
Sure, or it takes longer. Of course, it does take
yeah.
longer. But it's so important for kids to learn, number one, that they have a repetitive role to play in your morning routine. And number two, that they're able to earn your trust. Yeah. Like my 2-year-old already has earned my trust that if I give him something and I remind him, you know, that's breakable, right? Are you going to hold it underneath so that you make sure you don't drop it? And he's like, yeah. You know, like he's learning that I can coach him through something and he can build trust with me and actually learn how to do the whole process. The other thing is think about how many different steps there are in that process. Ironically, this process is one of the things that made me realize years ago that my grandfather was getting dementia because the way he was trying to put everything together, I was like, Dad, is Grandpa okay? I was like, I don't think he like lost the ability to put his coffee together because it is a multi-part sequence. Yeah. And he like had his coffee cup on top of the coffee pot and just that kind of thing. So with a baby, right, because a 2-year-old is effectively a, you know, they're in many ways still a baby, especially if you treat them that way. But if you help them level up through being exposed to opportunities like this, they learn how to do multi-step processes and they can take that sequence to virtually anything else. River can clean up after himself. I also give both Harley and River, they have chores just like the big kids do. Another great example, and I actually have a post on this exact topic on my Instagram. It's like 10 things I have my toddlers do that most of you would be scared of. Also, I have a special spray that I give them, but they're able to clean all of the cabinet fronts, right? So they like to sit there and spray and clean all the cabinet fronts. My 2-year-old likes to vacuum with me. He literally rolls out the whole vacuum on his own. He plugs it in. He knows how to carefully like put the prongs in the plug, and he tries to sit there and push it with me. Obviously, it's a little bit heavy, but these are just examples where most of you, if we're being honest, don't have your 7, 8, 9-year-old doing these chores, and our 2- and 3-year-olds are doing them.
That's right.
So, and they actually, if you start them then, they feel like they're a part of your family and they have a contribution. They have a job, they have a role. And then they don't resent it when maybe at age 10 or 11, you're like, hey, go vacuum. It's like, why would I want to do that? Where if your kids grow up doing those things, they feel like they're a part of the family unit. Yeah. So those are just a couple of examples of ways that a child can easily step in. Harley loves to cook. She's 3. So she'll do most of the steps. She's even gotten good at cracking eggs. So this is where we've talked about this a little bit, but sometimes our desire to do things quickly or efficiently or to keep things clean, they're like the 3 things that are going to hold back your kid the most.
Yeah.
You have to be okay with things taking a little bit longer. You have to be okay with things getting a little bit messier. Yeah. And you have to be okay with there being more risk on the table and increasing your ability to handle more and more risk, right? Because your kids are going to, you know, if our kids are doing this at age 2 and 3, at a certain point, you're going to have to be cool with your kid, you know, holding a knife.
That's right.
There are certain levels to this. And I lived in Hawaii for 6 years. And in Hawaii, it's totally normal in the culture of like husking coconuts and things like this. You'll be at a party and you'll see 4- and 5-year-olds with a machete cracking open a coconut. And that's normal. Whereas if you went somewhere else and you saw a 4-year-old holding a machete, you'd be like, oh my God, someone's a terrible parent in Hawaii. That was just normal.
Yeah.
Right. So it's all about how you incrementally level them up by teaching them, no, you can do that. It's a little scary, but you got this.
Yeah.
Into then learning that they can also build trust with you in that skill. So then they take it more seriously and there's more respect around the autonomy that you've given them.
Yes.
And I think a lot of parents, they wait until like 7, 8, 9, 10 when they're pissed that their kids are being little bleeps. And then they're like, well, I mean, the opportunity is here. So you can still, and I do that literally all day long with families in our parenting club where I'm helping rebuild those skills for 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. But I'm telling you, if you're here listening and you have young kids, let's start now. This is the time because the kids, they love it.
Yes, they do. Also, I want to give you an opportunity to invite moms to have a bit of a mindset shift around this, because I know that there are women listening who are probably like, oh, but they're only young for so long. Like, it's my job as their mom to take care of them. Like, I take pride in doing all of these things for them. Speak into that a little bit.
Yes.
Big picture.
So, but at the expense of what, right? Yeah. If you actually sit with yourself and are honest in that moment, I know it's not the socially acceptable thing to say, but that's actually self-centered.
It is.
right? But I want these times. These times are going to go away from me. None of that is focused on what's in the best interest of that child as they age. Yeah. So that's where we have to be willing to have a little bit more personal sacrifice here. And listen, I'm not saying, you know, turn your kid into a soldier and never cuddle them. Like, I'm the most cuddly mom ever. I'm all about the snuggles, all of that. But there needs to be a time and a place. You need to structure your day so that they have multiple opportunities to step into autonomy and independence and learn self-efficacy while knowing that if they really want you to snuggle, like, then you're going to snuggle them. It doesn't mean like you have to completely leave their childhood behind and turn them into an adult at age two. No one's right. asking you to do that. But we have to be a little bit more intentional, I think, about what each of our actions is doing or giving as an input to our child. Right? From the break method perspective, every input creates an output in the form of a brain pattern. So every input that you're giving, especially when it's repetitive, you are programming your child to be that as an adult. So you have to ask yourself some questions. Am I willing to deal with having what I want personally that makes me feel comfortable, that I want to cling to as a mom at the expense of my child's adulthood?
Right.
I think most of you, if you look at it that way, wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want to make that choice. But that doesn't mean that, again, you've got to turn your kid into a two-year-old adult. I'm a firm believer. One of the things that we absolutely need to do is help our child maintain their innocence.
Yeah.
That is what the world most takes away at those early ages. Mm-hmm. But innocence and self-efficacy, they have nothing to do with each other.
Agreed.
Innocence is going to be a byproduct of what you expose them to.
Yeah.
What you expose them to, I don't just mean, you know, what movies you let them watch, although that's certainly part of it, but what emotional experiences do you infuse into them? An example would be if you're constantly having a cyclical fight with your husband about something and you're doing it around your kids, you're exposing them to ideas and concepts that will be robbing them of their innocence. So the contrasting point to that is if you choose to still have those fights, but you have them behind closed doors, that actually has a very specific brain pattern output that usually creates a trust issue with your child because, bless you, children are highly aware, again, much more than we give them credit for. So if you're hiding that fight and you're pretending like it's not happening, your child is going to develop a trust issue and likely start to eavesdrop or try to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's more likely in break talk to push them into an abandonment wound. So when we look at it from this perspective, we've got to keep in mind that innocence is going to be maintained if we don't push, if we allow them to be playful and curious and explorative without persistently meeting them with a shame stimulus or something that again instills fear or gets them thinking about adult concepts that they don't need to be thinking about.
Right.
So I think those are the big things to keep in mind is that it just, with kids, our break method perspective is innocence, curiosity, and love. Those are the three things that absolutely have to be supported. They need to know that you love them, not for what they do, but for who they are without doing anything at all.
Yeah.
They have to be able to maintain their curiosity. So an example of this would be if your goal is always to keep everything clean and organized, their curiosity is going to get shot because everything that they're going to want to do potentially is now in conflict with how clean or orderly you want to keep things.
Yes. That's good news, moms.
Yes. It's good. I mean, and listen, I know a lot of moms that spend the whole day constantly trying to clean up.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to be bearer of bad news here, but, I've done this before as an experiment. That won't work. If you constantly want to maintain a standard, you're going to have to do it 10 times when really you could have had a peaceful, loving household all day that got increasingly more messy and then cleaned up one time.
Right.
That's more efficient, right? Your kids are going to be happier. Your family's going to be happier. And you have to build up resistance to not freak out about how disorganized things are in the effort of then just doing it one time and having it really clean right after they go to bed. Congratulations. You've just cleaned. Let me save you the trouble.
Okay. Okay. So give me some, so people who are listening can see a little bit of the bigger picture because, you know, when you're in it, you're in it. If the input is innocence and curiosity and love and self-efficacy and self-trust, what kind of outputs are we seeing, you know, 20 years down the road?
So interestingly, I would say the output is self-efficacy. So an example would be an input for self-efficacy is actually allowing your child to be exposed to risk, right? Then the output would be self-efficacy. If the input is spontaneous celebration of who they are, the output is that they feel secure in their identity and their identity isn't dependent on validation or perfectionism, right? Yeah. So I think it's a little bit more that way. So an example would be in break method, we talk about how in the early stages, right, we're talking about this kind of like birth to age five. Who you are is like an uncarved block of wood, and everything that happens to you with repetition takes a carving out. So eventually, by the time you're five, your brain pattern would be represented by the sculpture that you have been made to be by how your parents engage with you, the environment that was set into place, the structures that were either there or not there. And then that sculpture then goes out into the world and seeks some level of repetition or security based on what they think they feel safe in, right? Yeah. Every input is going to be that cut of the block, right? That whittling away of who I believe God made them to be, mm-hmm. right? If we look at it again from like more of a biblical perspective, this is where I think the Romans verse, be not conformed to the pattern of the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That really is kind of like the core verse that I think represents our philosophy and break method, which is what happens to you in those early childhood years, even if your parents are trying really hard, it's not going to support love, innocence, and curiosity all the time. In fact, often it's going to be in direct conflict with each one of those.
That's right.
You're going to feel unloved or shamed or cast aside or rejected when a sibling is born, right? Mm-hmm. That's just it's how things go. Your curiosity is going to be shut down by a parent being in work mode and not wanting to deal with the mess that you're making. You are going to get exposed to things like death and infidelity, like all the right, your dad is going to make that decision to put on a murderous movie when you're five and be like, oh, come on, honey, you'll be fine. We won't tell mom. And it's like, okay, well, now I have nightmares every night. Thanks, dad. Mm-hmm. Right. So those things do happen. We can't flat out avoid those things. Mm-hmm. But number one, we can be more intentional with if we're aware that those inputs or those carvings of the block have an output that's relatively permanent, right? Until a person goes and meets with you in your program or meets with me, pretty much they're not going to change. A person can only change so much without having some really definitive strategy behind it.
Right.
We just don't. We stay the same. We might convince ourselves that we're slightly changing or we change for a few weeks and then we default backward, but we just don't change completely.
Yeah.
I'm assuming with the work that you do, and I know with the work that I do, that does happen. You can completely 180 a person and their family and their kids, etc. But it's because we're mapping what inputs are creating what outputs and we're changing the inputs. That's so right. Obviously that's easier to do the younger your kids are.
Yes.
Because they haven't had years of the opposite repetition.
Right.
So I think the big things that we want to consider here are in terms of input, you as a parent learning how to emotionally self-regulate and not take things out on your kids, or even worse, not take things personally that your kids are doing or saying. And I know that that can feel hard for some brain pattern types, but mm-hmm. kids are kids. I've had my son, this only happened one time, and it was like pretty soon after I started dating my now husband, and he was going through a lot, but he just had this one meltdown. And I told him, listen, you don't have to stop crying, but you can't be doing this here in all of our space. So I totally understand if you need to cry this out. I'll come check on you, but you can't be having a tantrum this long in front of everybody else. So you can totally feel free to go to your room. And it went on and on and on. Eventually it quieted down for a while. And then all of a sudden I hear mom. And I'm like, yeah, can you hear me? Yeah. It's like, good. I hate you. And I was like, I love you too, buddy. Right. So a lot of parents be like, oh my God, my son hates me. I think at this point, my son was like 4 or 5. It's our job as adults to not take the bait of our kids, right? We can't take things personally. We have to see the bigger picture. Why are they hurting? Why are they reacting this way? Is there anything that I can take radical personal responsibility for that I did to set this whole thing in motion? Mm-hmm. So I think in those moments, that's where I think the biggest input is learning how to personally self-regulate. Number two, learning how to take radical personal responsibility. We often don't want to see the fault in our own behavior. But more than that, we often don't want to call it out specifically to our kids. That is the most important thing to do. When you've made a mistake, you immediately go on that with your kids. Right. That's an input that creates trust for sure. Yeah,
that's literally the next thing I had like circled on as I'm taking notes, because I want to kind of end there. I want you to talk about that a little bit, because just as we kind of where we started, right, kind of comes full circle. It's inevitable that we are going to do things that we immediately are like, dang it, that
I shouldn't
did not,
have done that.
Right? Yeah. People have those moments. And I want to talk about what is the, like, I want the research back. Like, what is the best way for us to repair with our kids? That gives them the best input.
Okay. So I'll share this in an example that we usually give to our students, because I think it helps set the stage. So I want everyone to go into this scenario with me for a moment. I want you to imagine that you're a mom and you've just taken your kid to Disneyland. Okay. Let's say that your kid's 3 in this situation. And usually this is paired with a big visual where it's lots of people on the bridge to the Magic Kingdom, you know, where like there's just so many people. And you're with your child, they're going to Disneyland for the first time, and they see their favorite character, and you can see the excitement. They want to run over to the character. And you can see, right, because you're taller, they're smaller, you can see that it's only a few feet from you, and they run to this character, and you're like, oh, that's so cute. But right at that moment, a sea of people come right in between you, right? So the little kid, from their tiny perspective, they look back to check in with mom, like, mom, are you seeing this? I'm seeing my favorite character. But what they see is a sea of people, and then they've decided, I just got lost at Disneyland. Oh my God, mom left me. Oh my God, I'm lost forever. I want you to keep in mind here, a child's perception of time is far different than ours because of their body's experience of gravity due to their mass, right? So literally how big we are changes our experience of the passage of time.
Yeah.
So where for us, maybe it was like 20 seconds, like, oh, please, you were fine. I could see you the whole time, 20 seconds, you were fine. I'm not a bad mom. Maybe for the kid, that 20 seconds felt like an eternity and they got lost at Disneyland. And maybe they're telling that story to future generations at the dinner table in front of you. And I was like, oh my God, remember that time you lost me at Disneyland? The mom wants to look at them and rebut. Oh my God, stop making up that story. Why are you lying? Okay. I want everyone to think of for a second how often little things like this happen where the kid's perspective and the parent's perspective of what happened are in direct conflict. And it's tempting for the parent to just want to shut that down and reassert reality, when the reality is they're also not trying to see their kid's perspective and acknowledge, oh, I totally understand how you could have seen this. I saw it this way. So I share this because most parents, if we think about our parents, I know for sure my mom would have been like, oh, please, you weren't lost. I was right there. It would have immediately been this like defensive, you really think that I would put you in harm's way like that, right? Now, this is how, from a break perspective, you handle a situation like that, right? You immediately see that they're crying. You go up to them and you say, what's going on? Well, mommy, I looked back and there was nobody there and I was lost. You left me. And you say, oh, I totally understand. Can I show you something? And you drop down to their height and you look back and you're like, oh my God, that must have been so scary. You couldn't see me. Can I show you something? You pick them up. And you lift them up to your right. See where mommy's head is? Do you see? I could see you the whole time. I'm so sorry. Next time, do you want me to make sure that I hold your hand? Or next time, I'll stay closer to you if you want me to stay closer to you. I thought that you were enjoying this time with your favorite animal and I wanted to take a picture. So I'm really sorry. And they're like, okay. The interesting thing is, if mom had done it that way and shown the different perspectives, that child probably would have dropped that and never talked about it again.
Yep.
But because the mom, in this hypothetical scenario, tried to say that didn't happen, you're wrong, the child held on to it and looped on it to the point where they're telling that story still when they're 22 years old.
That's right.
So if we use this example and we then look to any scenario where we've made a mistake or we've missed an opportunity to co-reconcile reality, right? Instead of like my version versus your version, how can we understand each other and heal this so that we can both move forward and not keep looping back on this again? It always has to start with, is there anything that if I go back and reflect for a moment, is there anything that I may have done that at least participated or set the stage for this to take place, right? That's the radical personal responsibility.
Yep.
Can I own that to my child while also asking questions to try to understand their perspective so that we can find a way to like build those together to move forward? Because most people just want there to be either I'm right and therefore you're wrong, or vice versa, right? Someone has to be a liar, when that's not actually how things have to work. We need to figure out how to be collaborative. And most people don't like that experience because it means that they have to face things about their own behavior or their own faulty perception of reality that that's makes great. Them go crazy.
Ooh, it's good. It's good. Okay. So you've been talking a lot about break method. Tell people like how does it work? Like, is it in person? Is it virtual? How do people get more information?
It's all virtual. So we have a few different programs. So we've got our primary program, which is our main offering. That is Break Method, the B2C version. So that takes on average 16 to 20 weeks. We offer it for individuals, for couples, and for families. So our family rate includes two parents and then one child. And then there's an add-on rate for each additional child. That is 100% online based. You have a full 4-module program of videos, and you also have two people as your behavior strategy team. So you have your behavior strategist that does all the diagnostic sessions, and then you have your client support team. The client support team is available to meet with you whenever you need them, but you also meet with them weekly. So there's 6 sessions total throughout the 20 weeks with your behavior strategist, and then client support is just ongoing as needed for support along the way. And then at the end of the program, you start your 30-day rewire period. And that's where you take essentially everything that you've learned. And that's where we sprint for 30 days and try to get to 100% accuracy. I will say that we always tell people we don't expect you to know any of this until that 30 days. But it's a bit of a distraction technique because usually when people are in module 3 before they're usually a month out from that, they're like, I literally don't know how I could change anymore. I'm a completely different person. How is that even possible? So then really the rewire period is just making everything sustainable and making that your new set pattern. Wow. So that's the primary program that we offer. We also have the Parenting Club, which I think I referenced a bit. That's for people that don't have the time and energy to put into the full break program, but are having issues at home that they need mitigated immediately. And that we offer in either 7-week increments or 16-week increments. And that can be done on an ongoing basis. But that is specific behavior strategy for the family, for each kid. We build out all the chore charts, the consequences, and we get to know what the family dynamics are so that we can build a strategy that changes things very quickly. And our rates of change on that, literally typically within a week, parents are looking at us like it's some sort of miraculous magic when it's really not. It's just mapping input output and knowing exactly what stimuli we have to change in the environment to get a better output. And then the last thing that we do is we train therapists, mental health professionals, and coaches all over the world in our method, and we run that twice a year.
Very cool. Okay. So for people that are interested, we'll put all of this in the show notes, but where's their best place to find you and connect with you?
Breakmethod.com. And then if you want to connect with me, I'm more active on social media. So I'm at BusyGold on social media, but then breakmethod.com for all things emotional rewiring.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. One, for being with us, but two, just for this work that you're doing. I think it's really important, and kind of how we mentioned earlier about having generational impact and generational change. I just champion you and your work so much because it really is so important. So on behalf of mamas everywhere, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you. You're an amazing interviewer and you're clearly brilliant and are doing all the same work. So right back at you.
Oh, thanks.
If you love Mommy's Podcast, leave a review.
If you enjoyed this episode, it would be so awesome if you could take a moment to subscribe and rate the podcast. And if you have just a few more seconds to leave a quick review, they really help to get this podcast out to other moms like you. I read every last review, and trust me, when it's late at night or early in the morning before my kids get up and I'm working on bringing you all of this content, your reviews are what keep me going. Leaving a review is truly the best way you can thank me. And of course, DM me on Instagram. I love to hear from you. Thanks for listening to another episode. Head over to the show notes for this episode and all past episodes at michellegrosser.com, where you'll find free resources and more ways to connect with me. If you love the show, share it with a friend. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next time.